Courtville. Good morning.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to our Gem Pursuit. I'm your host, Matthew Weldon. And as usual, I'm joined by my co-host, Elise Ketcher.
Bing. Hello, everyone.
We're on episode 5 of our special series called Jewellery Through the Ages. This time, we're stopping off in the 1940s. It was a tough time in the world, another global war threatening civilization itself. But can jewellery come to the rescue, Elise?
Jewellery can always come to the rescue. The one thing about the wartime is it's not all doom and gloom. We do have a sparkle in the distance, which of course is our beautiful jewellery. We also get to talk about some of the gorgeous pinups of this era who are not just beauty, but also brains, kind of like ourselves, Matthew.
Couldn't agree more, Elise. Let's get started. We're moving on from the Art Deco period onto something completely different. The 1940s jewellery, it is one of our favourites here, but there was a big dramatic change in the 1940s in jewellery, wasn't there, Elise?
There was indeed. I mean, if we think about the past few eras that we've talked about preceding the 1940s, what really stands out in the 1940s is a move towards military. Now, of course, 1939 to 1945 is basically taken up by World War II, which has devastating losses on both sides, but specifically to the Jewish people. And of course, many of those from this particular group of people had a huge amount of influence in the jewelry world, including the Asher family, who were all captured during this time. So it has, it's a really interesting period, not just to look at for jewelry, but in terms of what is happening historically. And it does set in motion a lot of what happens, the way that we work today and the languages that we speak today and the kind of the freedoms that we enjoy today kind of all come from what happened in the 1940s.
It's hard to get away from the World War II. Obviously, it dominated the first half, as you said. But there were quite a lot of different things that came out of World War II, which were quite important. And I think one that sticks out to me anyway, there was lots of new countries that were formed. So, I mean, the likes of Israel, India, following the war particularly, it sets a climate for independence. A lot of countries looked for independence. The global financial system was rebuilt at the Bretton Woods conference. Now, the reason why that's so important is that obviously the world financial system was destroyed during World War II, essentially, as was many of the world systems. But what they decided to do at Bretton Woods was they decided to get all of the major currencies and they pegged them to the US dollar. And the dollar then was backed by gold. America controlled about half of the world's gold. And in the 1920s episode, in our previous episode, which we discussed Art Deco period, America started to really come to the fore as a world power, and even more so after World War II. I mean, Europe was in.
And in between, we have the Great Depression. So yes. We have like this kind of dip, this major dip worldwide. And then we go into kind of World War II because of the repercussions of the kind of devastation from people not being happy about the Great Depression, obviously. So that kind of spurs us into the 1940s. And then obviously trying to, build something that was stable with an economy like this. This is what has kind of stabilized it, I suppose, is this conference that you're talking about.
Yes, yeah. It did. The mechanism it used was created the IMF after World War II, and it pegged the dollar to gold. So you could actually exchange a certain amount of gold for a certain amount of dollars, and then all of the other currencies were pegged to the dollar. Now, it lasted for quite a long time, and the effects of that are still seen today. But that was, so if you were to divide the 1940s into two parts, it would be obviously World War II at the start, and then post-World War II, and there was dramatic differences in that, but it's very important to understand there was a rebuilding process going on in the 1940s after World War II, which was fundamental to both jewellery, social changes and financial changes at the time.
As well, talking about gold, really the 1940s, gold is king. So because of the war, again, I don't want to kind of, you know, harp on too much about the war, but really this particular period, everything kind of stems from this kind of global thing that's happening at the time. So gold sees a huge resurgence. So before this, if you've listened to the Art Deco period, we talk a lot about platinum. Platinum was used in the Art Deco period and really celebrated for its fineness, its bright white sheen. But during World War II, platinum becomes a banned material as it's used only for war efforts. It was no longer allowed to be used in jewelry. So gold sees a resurgence, and we see really amazing designs in gold because of that, and really chunky pieces as well.
If you were to have invested in gold at the time of Bretton Woods, which was 1944, still the war was still ongoing, it was $35 to an ounce of gold, $35. So today, an ounce of gold is about $1,844 to an ounce. So obviously you would have increased your value enormously. Now I know what you think. What happens if you invested that $35, right, in 1944? How much would that be worth? So the $35 invested in 1944 would give you approximately $717 in today's money if you had invested it with compound interest and everything like that. So you still would have been more than double. Gold has more than doubled the rate of a standard like deposit account or something like that.
And that's so important to remember. People don't understand like the true value of gold. Gold literally never reduces in value. It fluctuates a little bit, but it always gains. And this is why gold, you know, especially in the 1940s war efforts, like this is what it comes down to. What is your bread and butter and in terms of economy? And gold is, you know, the gold standard, gold. And that's what the 40s the
word,
is about.
Even the word has just like a weighting to it. And I know gold is heavy as well. But
My eyes are like going gold. I'm like, I'm like a gold goblin. I love gold.
Yeah, that's a fact.
We also see the reuse of metals. So as you can imagine, rationing is happening during these times as well to make sure that people can be fed and people also have all of the other necessary things that they need during this time. And, you know, luxurious metals was not one of those things that was seen as a necessity. And so there was rationing. And gold in particular during this time was taken from other pieces and melted down and made into other pieces of jewelry. And so during the 1940s, we see kind of almost a patchy looking gold, not something that's bright yellow, but sometimes it has a little bit of a copper sheen to it, or it has little parts of the metal that actually looks different colors. So they're not all, it's not always a pure looking gold. It's kind of a melted down looking gold. And you see that a lot during this time. Also, we're talking about military. This kind of feeds into the fashions of the time as well. This is when the trench coat becomes quite widely worn by women. Previous to this, it would have been a men's jacket only.
Well, we were happy to share it, you know. But the fashions changed dramatically.
Yes.
I suppose because of practical reasons, and with a lot of the men off at war, women really stepped up in the industrial side of jobs that they previously wouldn't have done. And obviously the clothing had to change because it just wasn't practical to be doing physical labor in probably the styles of the 1920s, even though they had actually become slightly less flamboyant than Victorian and Edwardian styles. So it's funny, the fashions and the jewelry kind of tell you a lot about the time.
Yes.
And that's a theme, I think, through all of our episodes. But due to World War II as well, and I know Elise mentioned can't harp on about the war, but it is very difficult to get away from World War II in the 1940s.
Literally everything in the 1940s stems from the war. We also talk about marriages during the early 40s when men are being sent away to war. We have a huge amount of weddings and marriages that take place during this period. From 1940 to 1942, the rate of marriage soared, obviously because people are leaving to war and they kind of want to solidify something, control something in their life. But we're talking just about fashion there. When they returned, a lot of the pilots from World War II would bring back their parachutes, and the women would actually create their wedding dresses out of the parachutes from their husbands. And you can have a look online if you want to see some of the wedding dresses that were created with the parachutes of their husbands. Actually really beautiful dresses. But that's
so,
just a really
so resourceful
important.
In the 1940s.
Yeah.
I think people were. But there was huge technological advances as well. So there was the reuse. A lot of things were being reused, you know, jewelry and wedding dresses and thing and other aspects. I suppose people had to be prudent. But huge technological advances that were probably designed for war, but then probably were implemented in like a civilian context. I have a couple of interesting ones for you.
Love to hear them.
There's a few which are... very important. Velcro was invented, which I think is quite important.
Oh, for Matthew's shoes.
Yet to master those laces. The sound barrier was broken for the first time. Simple appliances that we take for granted today were really introduced in the 1940s, like the microwave oven. Tupperware was created.
Ballpoint pen.
Yeah, it's so like you can start to see, and this is what I love when we go in our journey in this series. You talk about Georgian, very few things in our Georgian episode were recognizable today. You get to Victorian, you start to see certain bits of technology, trains, steam engines, steamboats, in terms of large cruisers, were developed. And then Edwardian again, the technology advanced 1920s, 30s, electricity. Then you get to the 40s, and then we're getting more and more like today. Other important discoveries and other developments, cinema, and this would be a huge feature of the 1940s. Cinema starts to become really important.
And newspapers. So this is the thing, we forget a lot about how we actually got to this stage of warfare in the 1940s. And as you said, film played a huge part in that. The propaganda and the media that was used to actually, you know, create what the Nazi Party wanted to achieve was incredible. I mean, this is the kind of shows you the strength and the power of media, what it can actually do.
It probably was the social media of today, if you think about it. And people utilize it the same ways. Now, we won't cast any aspersions on people today, but Joseph Goebbels in the 1940s really utilized cinema and propaganda. So like Leni Riefenstahl, Triumph of the Will, like that was the equivalent today of, I think, someone having, you know, millions of followers on Instagram or Twitter or something like that. But he really was a master of that. And cinema would have been the social media of then. It was this new technology. You could reach a lot of people. Even discoveries in the world as well. Previously in Polynesia, it was thought that all of the Polynesian islands were settled from Southeast Asia. However, in 1947, Thor Heyerdahl's raft called the Kon-Tiki crossed the Pacific Ocean from Peru to Tahiti, proving that South Americans could have actually colonized Polynesia, whereas always thought before then it was Southeast Asia.
Well, this is a subject close to my heart because I am Polynesian by descent. We were always taught as children that we came from the Aztecs. Now, I don't know where that kind of came from in my family, but in New Zealand in particular, my great-grandmother always talked about our family arriving to New Zealand on canoes and on vessels. And they believed that we dropped people off all the way through the Polynesian islands until we arrived at Aotearoa, which is New Zealand, what we call New Zealand, the land of the long white cloud, because when they saw it, it emerged from a white clout. So,
What was the name? In
Aotearoa.
Right.
So, Land of the Long White Cloud.
It sounds gorgeous, really. Yeah.
Yeah. But there's a lot of similarities between New Zealand and Ireland. So, if you do get a chance, when they will let you back in there, go have a look around.
Yeah. It's beautiful. It's a little bit far away if you're over this side of the world. I actually think that New Zealand, I remember seeing this at one time, it is actually the furthest capital city from Dublin, I think, is Auckland in New Zealand. That is literally the opposite side of the world.
Yeah, literally the opposite side of the world. So, you know, we find out a lot about ourselves during each of these periods. You know, we find out, humanity is learning more and more and more. And it's unfortunate that through the 1940s that we actually have to learn about how our differences actually make us stronger through such a devastating loss. So, it's an incredible period. It's a sad period. But it's definitely a period worth mentioning. Talking about the 1940s and the actual jewelry from this era, I know Matthew and I were talking a little bit about trying to make sure that we differentiate for you without showing pictures, obviously, because we can't. But it's difficult to differentiate between the 1940s and the 1950s without, you know, actually seeing photographic evidence. So I'm going to go through some of the motifs and some of the things that you see specific to this period, and then kind of also go through some of the people who were the forefronters in terms of design, the jewelry houses.
Mm, exciting.
Yeah. So with the 1940s jewelry, the thing that I would say about it is it's very sculptural and it's very three-dimensional. When we think about the angular motifs and the geometric motifs of the Art Deco period, 1940s jewelry kind of still takes on an angular geometric style, but it's three-dimensional. So it's not something that sits very flat to the finger. It sticks out. It like really comes up. It's like a lot of truncated kind of styling. We see ribbons, but the ribbons are very much like raised edges. They're not flowing ribbons.
What do you think caused that movement towards this really three-dimensional, chunky designs? Because I know, like, you think in 1920s and 30s, it was, like, really sleek, like, almost, like, wearing, you know...
Material.
Like material. Mm-hmm. And then there was a dramatic change. What?
Well, a lot of it has to do, and, of course, 1940s, it has to do with the war. So one of the things that you see a lot during the 1940s is gold bracelets, but they're very, very chunky cuffed bracelets.
Mm, love those. Yeah. Typical French ones.
Yes.
You know, yeah, very cool.
But these, if you look at them, they actually look like the treads of a tank. So when you look at a tank and you see the wheels going around, these bracelets are actually supposed to look like the wheels of these tanks that were used during the war effort. So we see, really military during this time is what's driving the design. So it's all reflecting each other.
Yeah. And I think that's a beautiful description of it. That's exactly what it looks like.
Yeah.
If you're struggling to visualize that, just Google 1940s chunky gold bracelet and you'll see exactly it. That's a really beautiful description of the treads of a tank or the wheels of a tank going around. Yeah. And they are nearly that big as well.
Exactly. And this is what's really interesting, is because people are like, yeah, where do they get their inspiration during the time of war? Well, we also see a lot of animals. You know, Cartier's creating like the panther collection during this time, also tigers during this time, which we see on people like the Duchess of Windsor, and becomes extremely famous. Her brooch in particular, which has the capuchon sapphire at the bottom of it.
I mean, I know we're going to get to icons in a few minutes, but she could have been one for the 40s as well.
Absolutely.
Probably.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Already.
But they're more caricature. So when we look at animals from this period, it is definitely more caricature. It's not naturalistic. So you'll see like a lion that has more of like, you know, a cutesy face, I would say, than a fierce face that you would see in more of the Art Nouveau movement. So three-dimensional ribbons, the kind of folding of material. This is another kind of motif that you see during the 1940s. And also convertible. So we're talking about a thrifty kind of generation. So a decade-long period, we have convertible brooches that turn into neck pieces. We have brooches that attach to bracelets. We have brooches that turn into earrings. It's all about conversion during this time period as well to make the jewelry thrifty.
They didn't want jewelry that closely imitated nature too much. And in 1937... I think we might have touched on it. There was the International Exhibition of Arts and Techniques in Modern Life. And George Fouquet, who was a renowned jeweler, he was the chairman of the vetting committee. And at big shows like this, like we do antique shows all the time, and there's often people who vet the items, especially if it's an antique show. They come in and actually make sure that all of the pieces are antique, original antiques, not reproduction, not anything else. But his particular mission, I suppose, was not to refuse or discourage any project. So pretty much anything was allowed, except for those that were clearly influenced by certain historical style. So therefore, don't recreate Art Deco. Mm-hmm. Don't recreate Victorian. Don't recreate Edwardian styles. Has to be new or nothing that closely imitated nature. So it was open season, but you couldn't do that. And that's why there's such a difference. And you're talking about the styles there, and I think it's important to mention again, with women working a lot more in, you know, the factories and farms and in all the jobs that were left by men at the time who had to go to fight, the style became much more masculine. And I think there's a part there that because the feminine dress code of the 20s and 30s kind of left, I feel like that there was this part that the jewelry was an outlet to wear something feminine with all the masculine clothes.
Absolutely. That's one of the things that I was looking through some of the old Vogue magazines from the 1940s, and everything was always accentuated with a brooch. So a touch of femininity to the outfits. And of course the hairstylings were very feminine as well. But always kind of some kind of diamond on the body anywhere would have been, you know, something.
The brooches are fantastic from the 40s.
Incredible,
yeah.
And, you know, in film in particular, this is where the pinup girls become quite famous.
God, I wouldn't know anything about that.
Matthew's smirking over there. But the pinup girls become quite important, I would say, to kind of bring a piece of home with you, I suppose, for the men who were going away to war. But all of these pinup women were always adorned with jewels. And of course, we'll both have our own style icons that we'll be talking about. But
mine is a film star. Actually.
Exactly. Yeah. And mine is a pinup as well.
Yeah.
Because this is the birth of the pinup, the 1940s. The pinups of this time would have also been wearing specific designers, and the jewelry designers of the 1940s who were highly celebrated included Van Cleef and Arpels, Cartier, Chaumet, Harry Winston, and of course, Verdura.
I suppose just to another point that just when you were talking about the animal jewelry, so animal obviously had a lot of different textures and things to it, but that is a very important thing you'll see with 1940s jewelry. A lot of gold, not so much gemstones, or should I say, of course, a wire jewelry that had gemstones in it, but you'll see a lot more like large pieces of metal, whereas that would contrast to the 30s and 20s when it was, you know, the mystery setting from VCA, where they had gems set invisibly beside each other and all you could see in gems. In the 40s, you'd see a lot more metal work and the pattern of the metal. You'd see Florentine pattern, hammered paddle, woven kind of gold, plated gold, all these different textures. And that gave them a very distinctive era, a very distinctive flavor in that, in the 1940s, this different types of gold, in addition to different color golds. So green gold, yellow gold, red gold. What's that you're saying? Green gold? Yes, green gold was really a thing. It's quite rare, but I love to see green gold pieces come in. We have a beautiful brooch at the moment, which is from about that time, which is has green gold, rose gold kind of detail, and then a yellow gold background, which is really quite something special.
It's fabulous to see what happened during the 1940s because of the shortages of metals, of resources, because people were kind of stuck with the resources that they had. For instance, in France during this time, a special piece of jewelry could be made, but you had to supply all of your own metal and all of your own gemstones. And then what you did submit to be used was then partially taken by the French government as a percentage. So that was used for the war effort. So important to kind of remember that if you wanted a nice piece of jewelry at this time as well, that it could be made, but percentages of it was being taken by governments to fund what was happening at the time.
And it wasn't a huge deal for people, though, to do that. It kind of was a patriotic thing. So
no. And of course, lastly, during this period as well, I just want to mention the 1940s was a time of patriotic jewelry as well. So reflecting the time period, people wanted to show who their alliances were to. And of course, we see a lot of red, white, and blue being worn during this time. American flags surface. We also see,
which conveniently were actually Britain and France.
Yes.
And the Netherlands all have the same colours.
Exactly. So those colours were really championed during this time, and of course was great for wearability, because sapphire and ruby and diamond are all very wearable gemstones. So them together, you know, made it quite a striking piece of jewellery. And you can go in and see some of the examples from the major jewellery houses of this time as well.
Big, bold, colourful ones. And actually, just when you mentioned diamond, I just was checking Instagram there and we had some great questions. And we always do that just before a podcast episode. We'll request questions from people who follow us on Instagram. And there's one here from Kelly Marr, who just asked, what were the popular engagement ring styles? And I think it's quite an important point, because in the 1940s, it's probably the first decade where diamond engagement rings were the most popular. Previous to that, you would have different gemstones, and of course diamonds were fabulously popular before that, but not specifically for engagement rings. Yes, of course they were used in engagement rings, but it was really due to De Beers, the famous De Beers advertising campaign, and as Elise mentioned, the millions of engagements in the 1940s, that diamonds became the dominant engagement ring. If you know, asked a child today to draw an engagement ring, they draw kind of a diamond solitaire. That really became the mainstay in the 1940s. And that's a really good question, and thank you for asking that. There was a couple of other ones.
I have one here, which is by Lucy Kirsten. And it says, post-war, did jewellery become far more expensive or more desirable? This is a really good question, Lucy. Thanks for asking it. Just after the war, as you can imagine, you know, we're trying to rebuild ourselves. Matthew's talked a little bit about the conference that happened to kind of stabilize the economies again. But people were still, you know, after the Great Depression, the war, people were still very wary of putting their money into things like stocks or banks, and trust wasn't really there. So yes, we do see a huge amount of investment going into gold, into jewelry and tangible assets because of the distrust that kind of happened from the Great Depression. Now, that actually filters through a lot even till to today, with the older generations finding it harder to kind of like trust things that aren't tangible assets. Sometimes you'll hear people put their money into property. They put their money into something that they can actually see, visit, or touch. And jewelry during this time was a major investment.
Yeah. And as you said, the Depression, 1929, World War II, more recently, there was financial crisis, 2008 and 9. So people always saw jewelry and gold as such a safe haven in some ways, because you could see it, you could hold it. And funny, I'm lucky enough to have been able to hear stories about my grandfather who was in the business. And apparently he said the first two years of the war were not great for business. Everyone's kind of in shock. But he said the last couple of years of the war, he said, were an absolute boom time for estate and antique and vintage jewelry. Because they were tangible, there wasn't much else you could really buy, you know, and they lasted.
And they go up in price.
And they go up in price, you know, there's as we not, discovered.
Yeah, exactly. There's not a piece of antique jewelry that doesn't get rarer as it gets older, you know, because as you go through the years, the likelihood of it, of something being lost or stolen or broken up, makes these pieces rarer and rarer as you go along. And, you know, 50 years ago, 1940s jewelry would have been viewed kind of like to us what 1980s jewelry is.
Yeah.
But now it's like 1940s jewelry is something that people are searching for. They love the story connected to it. They love the look of the pieces, beautiful, chunky jewelry that, of course, tells a story.
Now, trade tips, and this is our section where we tell you one or two bits that we've picked up along our time working in the jewelry industry, just to help you identify and look for your special pieces, in this case, from the 1940s. Elise, what's your trade tip when you're looking for 1940s pieces?
I really love my trade tip today because it kind of helps to see into the future today, because during the 1940s, we see a huge rise in the use of synthetic rubies and sapphires. So it's something to look out for, especially if you're looking at these pieces. Of course, because they've got some historical value to them, it doesn't matter so much, other than if you're looking at a ring where, you know, the whole thing is just the sapphire, and that's really where all the value comes from. But if you're looking at the beautiful clips from this period, or bracelets from this period, or earrings or convertible brooches and things like that, I would say to you, synthetic rubies and sapphires, don't let it color too much, you know, your love for the piece. But yeah, really important.
Sorry, can I just mention one thing on that, Lisa? Sometimes synthetic becomes like a bit of a dirty word, yeah, in jewelry, but it's totally not, really, especially when it comes to rubies and sapphires, because they can be produced so effectively with virtually no carbon print at all, and the color and the quality would be fantastic. Yes, they won't be as valuable as like a natural, of course they won't, because they're not rare, but they are beautiful.
Exactly. But this is the one thing that I really wanted to talk about, because during the 1940s, synthetic rubies and synthetic sapphires per carat weight were on par with the natural counterparts.
Really?
So during the 1940s, they were considered just as valuable and just as rare. Now, I want to talk about this because I've seen coming onto the market synthetic diamonds. Now, synthetic diamonds on the market today can almost command similar prices to the natural counterparts of diamond. And this is a great way to kind of see where this is going into the future, because today, synthetic sapphires and synthetic rubies basically are worth very, very little. And natural gemstones, natural sapphires, natural rubies command the highest prices. So it's something that I want to give as a trade tip, because this is a trend that we see. We see new technology that brings out the ability to create something that looks and it has the same chemical composition as their natural counterparts. But in terms of actual investment value, it's not something to invest in. A synthetic counterpart to a natural piece is not something to invest in. And this is what my trade tip from the 1940s, which actually correlates to today as well. It's something that we can see that will happen in the future to synthetic diamonds. Don't pay the money that you would pay for a natural for a synthetic.
Yeah, fabulous trade tip. And I love how you've linked it to the 1940s. I didn't realize that synthetic rubies and sapphires were as valuable as the natural counterparts then, but it makes sense, because it was obviously more difficult to synthesize them. So there was expensive cost in that. But again, it doesn't mean they're not as beautiful, it just means they're not as valuable. My trade tip kind of links into that slightly. There's a question I was from Shireen. It was, how can an average person identify jewelry from this era? And thanks again for the question. We really get some great questions on Instagram, and they kind of help us guide these podcasts. But one of the ways you can identify it, and it's often something that could put somebody off a piece of jewelry. And I know definitely in Ireland, when we're looking at jewelry, we like something that feels chunky and substantial. However, in the 1940s, a lot of the chunky jewelry, although it's chunky in design, it's not very heavy gold. It can be quite light gold, actually. And when you pick it up, you might think, oh, that feels light. But the value is in the design, and it can be beautifully made. But whereas in the 1920s, because there was no war, there was more gold available to be used in jewelry and platinum. Platinum was obviously totally restricted in the 1940s. But you'll get these light pieces that are beautifully designed. They could be set with synthetic rubies. You might pick it up and feel, oh, this feels like a light ring. It mightn't be a nice piece. But that could be a very nice 1940s piece. So don't be, my trade tip is, so similar, don't be turned off by synthetic rubies or sapphires in 1940s jewelry. They won't be as valuable as naturals, but what you're paying for is the design and the beautiful gold patterns, and that's how you'll identify different textures of gold.
And folds of metal. I mean, you can't get more luxurious than the looks that they created, but in such a thrifty way, as you said. That's what it is. They were very, very thrifty, because they had to be. But it just shows you the kind of innovations that can take place when you've really got a fire underneath you.
And our icons of this era, as we've mentioned, cinema was like one of the new technologies.
I see a big, big smile on your face, Matthew.
At least I have a smile on my face every day I see you. Huh? And you, Ross. No, I just love, because I was looking actually up a lot of different people in the 1940s, and there was probably a few of them that you could have picked. I mean, and again, just to mention cinema, because it's, and again, jewelry tells you about the about what's going on in the world. So that you had the jewels of the cinema stars. Cinema is becoming popular, more mass advertising, mass newspapers, mass media, and that kind of show, and that's, you can see that coming through in the jewelry. They wanted bigger pieces that could be seen as well.
And Hollywood. So, you know, this is the birth of the starlets. I mean, we're talking about really incredible, beautiful pictures that kind of inspire fashion, inspire beauty, and of course the pinup. So, you know, which of these gorgeous ladies did you choose, Matthew? Because there's a lot to choose from.
Well, who I went with, I think, is a name we'll all be familiar with. But if I actually told you her birth name, you might not know her. Her birth name was Margarita Carmen Cancino, who is more widely known as Rita Hayworth, yes. And she was one of the preeminent, if not the preeminent, film star of the 1940s. She kind of was often depicted in a Mediterranean role or a kind of a femme fatale, and that is one of the reasons why her name was changed. But before I get to that, just to give you a bit of background, she was born in Brooklyn, New York, the eldest child of two dancers. Her father was a fella called Eduardo Casino, who was from Seville, which is in the south of Spain, which is very famous for their Spanish dancing. And her grandfather actually popularized the bolero dance. So, I mean, she had dancing
Love
in her
it.
Veins. Her father wanted to be a dancer. Her mother wanted to be an actress. And in a way, I think she kind of did the both, because a lot of her films were kind of ones that had dancing through
Mother
it.
Mother knows best, though, doesn't she?
Hmm?
Mother knows best.
Well, she was both. Yeah, well, it was both, really. But funny, the reason her name was changed, though, show in all of her early films. So, at the age of 16 in 1934, which is obviously just before the 1940s, but this is when she was starting to become to the fore, she performed one of her first dance sequences as kind of an exotic foreigner in space or trance film Dante's Inferno. Then after that, she was in a film called Under the Pampas Moon, which is 1935. Then she was an Egyptian girl in Charlie Chan in Egypt. And then she was a Russian dancer, okay, not quite Mediterranean, but all of these roles, you can see they're pretty similar.
You get typecast, definitely. If you look at any of the ladies, the pinups during this time, they were all typecast according to their looks.
They were, but this is when her name changed, because she was signed by Columbia Films. The head of the studio at the time was a fella called Harry Cohn. Signed her to a 7-year contract. And he argued that her image was too Mediterranean, and to be like an American star, she had to change something. So what they did is they changed her name from Cansino to her mother's name, which was Hayworth. And instead of Margaret, they called her Rita Hayworth, which was much more an American name. Also to dye her hair to a reddish color. So she seemed more, and apparently had electrolysis to change her hairline to make her look more American. She, in the 1940s, she recorded a lot of her most famous films. I think one of her big first hits that some of us might know is a film called Gilda, where she was really just where she got the real image of being a femme fatale and like a developer and be one of these pinups that you mentioned. And so much so that the US Army, when testing a nuclear bomb, they put out a picture of her and put her on the bomb. I think they called the bomb the Hayworth bomb, and she went ballistic over this. She was not happy at all. And it was said that her daughter wanted to be able to tell her granddaughter that it was the last atomic bomb was ever used, was one with her picture on it, because she was so anti it. Anyone who's watched The Shawshank Redemption, the lady, the picture on the wall is, of course, of Rita Hayworth. The book is actually called Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption. So that iconic image that is used to obviously cover the hole that Andy Dufresne digs his way out of the tunnel, that is Rita Hayworth. And again, complete pinup. She was also the first Hollywood princess. There has been a few since. But she got her second marriage was to a Prince Ali Khan. Final bit of information about Rita Hayworth that I would say is she had a famous, famous set of jewelry. And it was in the 1947 film called Down to Earth. And she wore a typical piece of jewelry from the 1940s, which is a Tubo Gaz necklace, bracelet.
I absolutely love them.
Yeah. And again, this looks kind of military as well.
Yes.
For anyone who's not familiar with Tubo Gaz, it's like a link that kind of, they move in and out of each other. And they're semi-flexible.
Almost like a three-dimensional snake chain.
Yes, and that's exactly what this was. It was a serpent jewelry in the 1940s. They were set with emeralds, and they are an iconic set of jewelry, which really sums up the 1940s jewelry and worn by one of the greatest pinups of all time.
Well, I might have to contest the greatest pinup, because mine is also a pinup. Her name, of course, was Hedy Lamarr. who's most of the pinups as well, like Matthew, Zarita Hayworth, they were actually had their names changed to make them more anglicized, I would say, or to make them more westernized. Hedy's real name is Hedwig. Which comes from Austria, and her father was a very well-off Austrian banker in Vienna, but they were Jewish. She was born in Vienna in 1913, and she got married very early. In 1933, though, I'll go first to 1933, just before she got married to her first husband. She is known as one of the first women to actually appear naked on film. I know, especially during the 1930s, this was quite frowned upon and seen as something that was incredibly indecent. She has full body shots of her naked in this film, and it's actually quite a funny one because she's swimming in a lake, and just swimming in a lake by herself, and her horse is next to the river, and the horse has her dress on the back of on top of the horse, and the horse gets spooked and runs off, and she has to run after the horse naked. So it's quite comical. She gets caught behind a bush, and a guy kind of like has the horse with her dress on it, and she's like, well, it's actually a pants, a jumpsuit, and she's like hiding behind the bush, and then he gives her her clothes back, and she puts her clothes on, and they have a talk. But anyway, this kind of sets the scene for her. As a child, she was never, her mother never kind of focused on her beauty. But she said it wasn't until she got a little bit older that she realized that she was getting noticed by many, many people for the way that she looked. She got married pretty soon after the 1933 film called Ecstasy, where she appears naked. Her husband was an arms dealer who was also Jewish, and one of the only Jewish arms dealers to actually still have favor with the Nazis, even though he was Jewish. But she found the relationship extremely excruciating because he wanted to control every aspect of her life, right to the point where he used his millions to actually purchase as many of the ecstasy films as he could to destroy them so that no one would be able to see her. So he was quite controlling.
Well, at least our sales would look good.
Exactly. He wanted her to just be a little doll in a box is what explains the relationship. Now, what's really interesting about her, though, is that she gains a lot of jewelry and gifts from this particular husband. She's married to him from 1933 to 1937. She gains as much jewelry as she can from him. And then she hires a maid that looks similar to her, leaves the maid in the house, sews all of her jewelry into her clothing, and escapes him to France. She goes to France and she uses the jewelry actually to kind of secure her future. And she gets a divorce from him in France in 1937. And then she gets spotted in the UK. She's introduced to MCM, the management for Hollywood. And then she becomes this amazing Hollywood starlet. Now, in every single picture that you see of Hedy Lamarr, she is draped in jewelry. She has incredible necklaces. She's always wearing a brooch if she's not wearing a gown. She has drop earrings. She is probably considered one of the most beautiful women in the world. And there's one really famous quote that she talks, where she talks about herself. And it's really quite sad because we're talking a lot about these women of this time, their beauty. But Hedy Lamarr was actually not just outstandingly gorgeous, but she was also an inventor, and she was also someone who actually helped in the war efforts herself. So when war did break out, she was in, you know, a number of massive movies. Boomtown was one, Comrade X was one, White Cargo, Ziegfeld Girl, which is my favorite of hers, where she wears a beautiful star costume. I don't know if you look it up, she plays alongside Judy Garland, but she wears this star costume where she's got a star on her forehead and she has stars all around her head and a floor-length gown as well. And it's here that she says about jewelry, she said, "I'd rather wear jewels in my hair than anywhere else." And it's because she believed that the face should have the advantage of this brilliance. She believed her face was the most important thing about her, was her face. And it's really sad because in her later years, because she starts to age, she becomes a recluse and hides away because she no longer looks the way that she did in the 1940s. But lastly about her... you know, we're talking about her star-spangled evening gowns and her dazzling showgirl costumes and the jewelry that she wore. Her contribution to technology as an inventor is probably one of the most unknown things about her. And actually, she didn't actually get the recognition for it until 2000. And this was, you know, the year that she passed away. But she was actually partial inventor of Wi-Fi. So she is really, really important to us today. I mean, let me go into it a little bit more than that, because obviously you're like, Wi-Fi, how is she the one who invented Wi-Fi? So she created with George Anthill a patent for a secret communication system that they devised. And it was used to basically the airwaves that were at the time. She used the airwaves to kind of create a patent that allowed people to communicate with each other. Now, her thought was, okay, we can do this so that we can kind of interrupt the communications between warships and then actually be able to, you know, have wireless communications between our war vessels to allow them to attack enemy ships. So she created this kind of, she did create a wireless communication between two parties. Now, that basis, like that primitive basis that she created, has now been used in the development of Bluetooth, GPS, and Wi-Fi.
Incredible.
So yeah. She wasn't just her surface appearance. She was brains. She was incredibly intelligent. And what's really upsetting is because she was so beautiful, the Navy rejected it. So they didn't use it. And it wasn't until she had become a recluse in the 1960s that they started to use her patent. 1959 was when the patent ran out. So they started using her technology after the patent had run out. And I find that really kind of distressing.
It was just silly for the army as well.
Well, anyway, it is, but I mean, you can go in and look at her. She is so gorgeous. She is a beauty, but she had something to contribute more than just her looks.
It reminds me of Amy de Irene, who we talked about previously as well. Like, yeah, some fantastic icons and idols of this time. And of course, being through the 1940s, who thrived in such a difficult environment, I think they're really quite special people. So this week's gem, Trivial Pursuit, it's 5-4 to myself. So still very close, all to play for. And of course, we still have over half the series to go. So no doubt there'll be a few twists and turns.
I'm pretty sure you're not going to get one single question right.
I'm full of surprises, I'll have you know.
Oh, and right. By looking at these questions, I don't think I would get any of them right.
Well, I'll go first then because
No, I'm going to go first.
If I got to get them all wrong, it's like, all right, you go first, Elise. You go first.
Okay, yeah. Matthew, question one. Okay. Whose play Death of a Salesman premiered on Broadway in February 1949 and is considered by many to be one of the greatest plays of the 20th century?
Arthur Miller. And thank you, Mr. Fitzpatrick in Temple Oak College. Read that book and Death of a Salesman resounded with me remarkably, as you can probably imagine. So yeah, and
there's gonna be death of a producer.
He had a oh no. Let's keep it calm here now. So no sort of that carry on set. But he had a very colourful life as well.
Actually. Okay, question two. Which 1940s crooner is considered to have been the world's first ever teen idol?
Which 1940s
crooner?
What? What's a crooner?
A singer.
Oh, a singer. Does Ross actually say crooner on that, does he?
Yes.
All right. Became the first ever...
Because he's trying to give you a clue. But, by the look of it, somebody doesn't have a clue.
Okay, just sorry, read it once more for me there. Just
which
so
1940s crooner?
Okay.
Or singer? Is considered to have been the world's ever first teen idol. Like a
Justin Bieber of the 40s.
Yes.
Right. I have no idea. I'll just say... I don't even know.
Say anything.
No, that could be worse than saying nothing. I'll say nothing. I'll pass.
He's learned that from Pride and the Prejudice. It's Frank Sinatra.
Oh, yeah, okay. Fair enough, yeah.
Question three. Humphrey Bogart was one of the biggest Hollywood stars of the 1940s.
Okay.
But can you tell me how many times he was married?
Seven.
Although you looked very confident in that answer, the correct answer is four. Wow. He was married to Helen Menken, Mary Phillips, Mayo Methote, and Lauren Bacall.
That's quite...
Lucky ladies.
I did notice a lot of people got married in the 40s tend to have... some of the film stars, they got married six and seven times.
Yes, Hedy was married six times.
Yeah. Yeah, that's quite prolific. Okay, thank you very much, Elise. That's one out of three. So let's have a look. You need two out of three to draw level at the moment. Now... First question, what American wrote the 1940 novel For Whom the Bell Tolls, inspired by his experience as a journalist during the Spanish Civil War? Oh, Elise's head is just tilted to the side there. Just looking at Ross. It's difficult, difficult decade questions. He's an American novelist.
Mark Twain.
Ernest Hemingway. Question two. Jazz band leader Edward Ellington and his orchestra had a hit in 1941 with Take the A Train, but by what nickname was he better known?
Say his name again.
Edward Ellington. 1941 hit Take the A Train. Any ideas? Do you want to hazard a guess?
No, pass.
Duke.
What? Anyway, go on. Russ is getting Duke Ellington and putting his hands up in the air. Yeah, okay. Frank Sinatra for Matthew.
I think I'm the only person with one question right today so far, actually. But Ginger Rogers was one of the biggest icons of the 1940s cinema. But can you tell me how many times she was married? Ginger Rogers.
So let's go for six.
The answer is five. She was married to Jack Pepper, Lou Ayres, Jack Briggs, Jacques Bergerac, and William Marshall. So
Matthew, you're still winning.
Yeah, I'm as surprised as you are, to be honest. But nevertheless, that's the way these twists and turns go. I really enjoyed that, Ross. Thank you for creating those questions.
I think I didn't.
Well, as they say, as Christian used to say, they're only easy when you know the answer. So look, we're going to wrap it up there today, everybody. I really hope you enjoyed the episode. We'd love to hear from you. And so do send us any questions or comments on our Instagram. That's at matthew.weldons. And if you like the podcast, we'd really love if you would leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It just helps people kind of find us and so on and get the podcast out there. And hopefully more people can join us on this gem pursuit. I'd like to thank Elise for joining today and being the co-host. Thank you, Elise.
Very grateful. Thank you, Matthew.
And our producer, Ross, as always, who puts together these episodes. And most of all, thank you all for listening, and I will talk to you the next time. All the best.